all around Australia. This is Radio National Summer Breakfast.
This is AM. Good morning. I'm Eleanor Hall. Queensland emergency workers are preparing to evacuate 2,500 people from the town of Emerald as the flood crisis intensifies across Queensland. The Nagoa River reached record levels overnight and is still rising, and already 80% of Emerald is underwater. Yesterday, the town of Condamine was completely evacuated, and in Rockhampton, residents are bracing for a flood peak that's expected to hit this weekend. We'll go to Rockhampton in a moment, but first, David Marks spoke to the Queensland Minister for Police and Emergency Services, Neil Roberts.
Well, the main focus of attention, particularly overnight, was in the township of Emerald. Currently, there are around 1,291 people who are registered as evacuees. That is, they're out of their homes. We do expect that to grow to up to 2,500 in the next 24 hours. 394 people stayed in three evacuation centres, but of course with the significant increase in the numbers today, we're expecting that to be much, much larger tonight.
And I understand that 80% of the town will be underwater. Is that the case?
Yes, and that's heading towards that now. It's quite a significant impact, probably the largest flood that the town has experienced probably in its history. In addition to that, the townships of Bundaberg, the Bundaberg situation peaked yesterday, but there's still a lot of homes with water in and around them. Overnight, of course, the other small township of Condamine, 82 people were evacuated using Defence Force helicopters. Of course, Rockhampton is the looming problem today and over the weekend with significant rainfall leading to significant rises in the river there in the next 24 hours.
You mentioned the 80 people who had been evacuated at Condamine. Reports say that many of them were reluctant to go. Why was that?
We have experienced that in a couple of instances at Theodore. And look, it's as simple as in some instances, people not wishing to leave their pets, believing they want to stay and protect their property. And that's perfectly understandable. We have given the police and emergency services agencies powers of compulsory evacuation. They've had to have been used in very few situations.
The flood peak is yet to hit Rockhampton. How many people will be affected there?
Well, potentially thousands again. The rocky flood is going to be really significant. They're talking about flood levels of at least the 1991 flood, where it peaked at 9.3 metres. The predictions are that it will go higher. So there's been a lot of preparation. Thankfully, you get a little bit more time in places like Rockhampton to do the planning to make sure that evacuation centres are fully prepared for what could be quite a significant influx of people as well.
How many people will have to leave their homes throughout Queensland as a result of this flood crisis?
It will be thousands. If you're looking at Emerald, 2,500, potentially in Rockhampton, 1,000, 2,000, the figure will just be fluid as time goes by. And look, it's just heartbreaking. People had very little notice in some circumstances, but even those that did, that moved possessions to higher places in their homes, on top of beds, on top of kitchen cabinets, etc., have seen the water rise to higher levels. So some people have lost everything. It's just been very, very devastating. And I think the real impact of a lot of these events is sometimes not realised till weeks and sometimes months afterwards.
That's Queensland's Minister for Police and Emergency Services, Neil Roberts, speaking to David Mark. Emergency evacuation centres are now opening in the Queensland centre of Rockhampton as the Fitzroy River there continues to overflow. Yesterday, the river burst its banks and the floodwaters are expected to peak above 9.3 metres in the next 48 hours, as we heard there from the Minister. But several homes are already underwater. Josh Babbis is in Rockhampton. He spoke to residents as they were preparing to leave their homes.
Scaffolding planks jammed in window sills are all that's keeping Michael Donnelly's possessions out of the murky floodwaters. The 70-year-old spent all night preparing his home for the expected water level rise.
I've got a fridge. I just recently bought a fridge and a freezer, but I'm going to put them up on planks too in the kitchen, because I'll hate to come back to this and the fridges are ruined, so they got to go up,
Last night, floodwaters from the nearby Fitzroy River were already lapping at Michael Donnelly's front door. He lives just two blocks away from the river in the low-lying suburb of Depot Hill.
When the water started to come, you got no idea of the comradeship amongst the residents. They're all out joking In fact, I was leaning on my porch there around the corner and I said, oh, I left the gates open to let the water out, you know.
And just down the street, another local resident, Esther Madsen, was rushing emergency supplies to her family. Her son used a canoe to pick up the food and drinking water.
Yeah, my daughter-in-law phoned us and asked us if we could get us some things that the kids needed, some fruit and some toilet paper and bits and pieces, so we added a few. The SES men stopped us to see what we were doing, and as we weren't sightseeing, they let us walk a bit further and told us where to stand while our son came through. Our grandson came through on his push bike to tell us that Dad was on his way.
Around these suburban streets, less than a kilometre from the town centre, residents are noticing toads and jumping fish in the dirty water swirling around them.
It looks pretty crappy, doesn't it? And the thing is you don't know what's in it.
Tina Masling says there's at least 100 homes in this particular suburb which are below the flood level mark from 1991. It peaked almost half a metre lower than this weekend's predicted flood level.
A lot of them are elderly people and pensioners, and they're going to lose a lot of it. A lot of it wouldn't be insured. You know, a lot of devastation everywhere. Still checking, trying to get people out because people won't leave their houses either because, you know, animals, whatever else. There was horses up in the front yard of a house up around the corner because all the horse paddocks down the back are flooded.
Residents have been told to make arrangements for their pets, as many won't fit in the evacuation centres. But the rising waters aren't keeping locals out of the nearby pub, which has been dubbed the Fitzroy Flotel. Hotel patron Robert Simpson says they're preparing for a repeat of what happened nearly 20 years ago.
And the boats were parked right where we are, waist deep, and the boats were all anchored off the rails right along here.
He says there's still plenty of beer, but it'll be rations over the next week.
Plenty, but you can't get a cart and take away. I've tried that. Everything's up, they've got all their gear up. Now it's just a matter of waiting and see what's going to happen.
That's Rockhampton local Robert Simpson speaking to our reporter Josh Bavis. And Josh Bavis joins us again with the latest. Now, Josh, you've moved to the business centre of Rockhampton. Just how high are the floodwaters there now?
Yeah, good morning, Eleanor. Right now I'm just on the edge of the CBD and the floodwaters have stayed above the 8-metre mark all night. Now, right now I'm looking across about a 200-metre stretch of the mighty Fitzroy River. And, you know, many people think a flood is just clean water moving through, but no, this is in fact dirty, muddy water charging through Rockhampton and already starting to inundate homes here. You can just smell the mud in the water here. Now, in front of me, Riverside Park has just gone underwater. Last night there was supposed to be a music concert held here, but that had to be shifted to a car park in town because the park simply is no more.
How fast are the floodwaters rising?
Well, it stayed pretty constant overnight, but that's expected to rise over the next 48 hours by at least a metre, maybe even a metre and a half. Now, that's really bad news if you're on the river, if you're a riverside property owner. Now, already we're seeing some of that impact on residents.
We heard some residents in your piece a moment ago saying there was a lot of comradeship. Are you picking up any sense of panic?
Well, last night people seemed fairly calm. I mean, they were moving their furniture above what the expected flood level is to be this weekend. But, I mean, the shops are running out of milk and bread are the first things to go. And as we've heard, the rail and road into and out of Rockhampton has been cut. Everything is coming in by air now. So hopefully supplies can be airlifted in because it will be getting pretty thin over the weekend.
Are you able to gauge how many people have left their homes so far?
There's been at least in the hundreds at this stage. I mean, just flying over the town yesterday, you could see some of the rural properties. They had gone completely under. You could see just some roofs out in the floodwaters on the plains.
Josh, is there any resistance to leaving from people you've been speaking to?
At this stage, the State Emergency Service has suggested some people leave. Now, they're staying to see how long they can remain in their homes for. They have pets, they have animals, and I've been told that there won't be enough room for all of the pets at the emergency evacuation centres. So residents are being told if you have animals, get them to higher water now, make plans for them because there simply won't be enough room.
Is there a large contingent of Defence and Emergency Services people there in Rockhampton?
At this point in time, I understand they'll be in the more rural areas that are being affected first. Now, as these floodwaters come in, it will be affecting the inner city areas, so I understand that they'll be moving closer to the city in the coming days.
And where are these evacuation centres?
Now, that will be the first one will be opening at the Central Queensland University later today. Now, I understand some people are already packing up and making their way now. And it'll be a trying time for the residents over this weekend.
Indeed. Josh Bavis in Rockhampton, thank you. You're listening to AM around Australia on ABC Radio National, where it's 20 minutes past seven. Overseas now, an Israeli court has found a former president of the country guilty of rape and sexual harassment. Moshe Katsav committed the crimes against several of his former staff, both during his presidency and when he was a cabinet minister. Although he always maintained his innocence, the charges forced him to step down 3 years ago. Now he faces between 4 and 16 years in jail. Middle East correspondent Anne Barker reports.
Ordinary Israelis have long believed Moshe Katsav was guilty, even before the verdict, and a crowd of demonstrators was waiting outside the court. Katsav to jail, read one placard. You are not alone, said another, referring to his victims. The former president has always denied the charges, saying it was him who was the victim of a political witch hunt. But in the end, the judges accepted the evidence of the women he raped and sexually harassed. The testimony of Katsav was riddled with lies, the judges said in a unanimous verdict. When a woman says no, she means no. Katsav was found guilty of 2 counts of rape of a former ministerial aide while he was a cabinet minister, as well as sexual harassment and indecent sexual acts against other former staff. The first rape took place in his office and the second at a Jerusalem hotel. No date for sentencing has been set, although rape in Israel carries a penalty of at least 4 years jail. But his lawyer, Zion Amir, has indicated the former president will lodge an appeal. This is one stop along the way, he told reporters. Outside the court, other Israelis welcomed the verdict, and women's groups say it sends an important message to other victims of sexual assault. Miriam Schlur heads the Rape Crisis Centre in Tel Aviv.
It's a very, very important day, and it's a very, very important message to all the rape victims in Israel that were abused by men in power, in positions of power, that they can file a complaint and that the justice system and the legal system will do justice.
Moshe Katsav was born in Iran and migrated to Israel with his parents at the age of 6. His rise to the presidency was seen as an example for other Jewish immigrants from disadvantaged Arab nations. And as president, he was long held up as a model of morality for all Israelis. But he's not alone in his fall from grace. A former Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, is on trial on corruption charges, and a string of other senior officials have been indicted or jailed for their abuse of power. For some, Moshe Katsav is just the latest proof that even the most powerful figures in Israeli public life are in the end equal before the law. This is Anne Barker in Jerusalem for AM.
It's a strategic ally of the United States and is still struggling to deal with its own flood emergency. Now the government in Pakistan is on the brink of collapse. Pakistani President Asaf Ali Zardari held crisis talks with his coalition partners overnight amid fears that the government could lose its majority in the parliament. South Asia correspondent Sally Sara reports.
2010 has given little relief to millions of people in Pakistan. The government is still struggling to deliver basic services and security in many parts of the country. Now it's facing political instability. Two ministers from the MQM party submitted their resignations as part of a feud with the ruling Pakistan People's Party. The ministers didn't take the extra step of crossing over to the opposition benches, but their actions have been enough to unsettle the government and prompt talks between the president, Asif Ali Zardari, and senior members of the MQM. 2 weeks ago, 7 MPs from a leading religious party also walked out in a separate dispute. The latest incidents come at a time when Pakistan is under increasing pressure from the US and other members of the international community to play a greater role in the fight against terrorism. The US has launched hundreds of drone attacks on suspected militant bases along the border with Afghanistan. Columnist and political analyst Musharraf Zaidi says the new year is expected to focus even more attention on Pakistan.
I think what we'll see in 2011 is a significant ramping up of both political and media pressure on Pakistan, as well as counterterrorism measures that are already in place and that are already being conducted. Things like drone strikes have already increased dramatically under President Obama. As the counterterrorism group within the White House becomes more dominant over the counterinsurgency groups in the White House and the Pentagon, we'll see an even greater degree of dependency by the Obama administration on counterterrorism measures in Pakistan, such as drone strikes. Of course, these drone strikes are politically, they're really radioactive, and they cause a significant degree of loss of face for the U.S. and Pakistan, and a number of problems, especially in the tribal areas, for the governments there. So I think in terms of Pakistan's strategic importance, it absolutely will increase, and so will the pressure on Pakistan militarily, from an intelligence perspective, politically, and through the media.
As the US and its allies plan the gradual withdrawal from neighbouring Afghanistan, Pakistan's long-term strategic significance is increasing. The country's internal political problems are being watched carefully by those with a stake in the region. This is Sally Sara reporting for AM.
2010 was a boom year for solar energy companies in Australia. A Clean Energy Council report shows that more than 100,000 solar power systems were installed as householders took advantage of the range of federal and state incentives. But the head of Australia's only solar cell manufacturing plant says the government support is directed at retailers and has done little to support the local manufacturing industry. Jennifer Macy reports.
Nestled among the stadiums and sporting venues at Sydney's Olympic Park is Australia's only solar cell factory. Silex Solar produces photovoltaic or PV cells that are fitted to rooftops to produce electricity from the sun. Rod Sears is the general manager.
This is our cell manufacturing line. We have about 100 people working here on a 24/7 basis, and we can produce more than 50,000 cells a day. We take a silicon wafer and then we etch the surface to improve the reflectivity of the surface, and then we take it and we put a phosphorus layer on it, and then later on we print silver lines on it to make a cell.
Silex Solar bought the factory in 2009 after BP Solar took its manufacturing offshore. Various state feed-in tariffs and a federal government rebate has made rooftop solar affordable for many households. But Dr. Mike Goldsworthy, the CEO of Silex Solar, says while the incentives have helped retailers, manufacturers have missed out.
So it's been a year of strong growth, but unfortunately it's been a year of extreme competition from particularly the Asian manufacturers. For example, the framing for our panels, we can source from China or other places in Asia. If we source from China, you wouldn't believe it, but we have to pay a 16% import duty on the framing. The Chinese panels that come in do not have any duty coming in. So there's a huge imbalance. We don't have a level playing field at all.
The CEO of the Australian Solar Energy Society, John Grimes, says government support for renewables has been ad hoc and knee-jerk.
We need better coordination between the various levels of government. We need certainty and visibility, and I think we need to start to treat the solar industry with a bit of respect. Solar now employs over 14,000 people in Australia. That's over half the number of Australians employed in the coal industry. So it's a significant industry in its own right.
The CEO of Silex Solar, Dr. Goldsworthy, says the industry wants the government to decide on a carbon tax or trading scheme soon to ensure stability.
Well, do we want an Australian manufacturing industry? The Australian manufacturing industry is suffering in all sectors. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, we are selling our manufacturing down the drain, essentially. It's really sad to see that, you know, Australian manufacturing is shrinking to almost an insignificant part of the economy, to the point where we're going to have to import everything we buy, everything we use is going to have to be imported.
And he says unless there's better coordination between the state and federal governments, the industry will again struggle to compete with Chinese imports in 2011.
Jennifer Macy reporting. And now to finance in New York. The Dow Jones is trading at 11,576. That's down 9 points. The Nasdaq is down one at 2,666. In London, the FT 100 is also down, closing at 5,971. And the dollar is buying 101.59 US cents, down 0.10 on yesterday's close. I'm Eleanor Hall. That's AM for today.